Hello everybody. This is the translation of Pascal Girard's message for Sunday the 24th of April. This morning I would like us to reflect on the role of the Church, but we would not finish talking about it if we had to describe everything and in detail about what makes the Church. Entire volumes have been written and printed which remind you or reveal to you what the Church is from its creation to the present times, passing through its evolution over the centuries. So I will content myself with evoking with you the importance and the intensity of the relationships that we can know in the Church from well-known events and the few corresponding biblical texts, precisely three. You will easily realise that to approach the first biblical text that I have chosen, I will be forced to go back a few days. Last Sunday we celebrated Easter. Easter, the day of resurrection, contrasting with the days of sadness, suffering and death that Jesus had just experienced. Our reading is taken from Mark chapter 14, verses 32 to 38. They went to a place called Gethsemane, and Jesus said to his disciples, "Sit here while I pray." He took Peter, James and John along with him, and he began to be deeply distressed and troubled. "My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death," he said to them. "Stay here and keep watch." Going a little farther, he fell to the ground and prayed that, if possible, the hour might pass from him. "Abba, Father," he said, "everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me. Yet not what I will, but what you will." Then he returned to his disciples and found them sleeping. "Simon," he said to Peter, "are you asleep? Couldn't you keep watch for 1 hour? Watch and pray so that you will not fall into temptation. The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak." Firstly, Jesus wants to be accompanied. To the sadness openly exposed in this story is added for Jesus the anguish faced with the thought of the accomplishment of the unjustified, cruel and so dreaded event, the crucifixion on Good Friday. On Good Friday, it feels like the world is holding its breath. What happens on Good Friday is both unthinkable and momentous. Everything changes. In Jesus, God lived among us. He couldn't bear to be away from us any more, or rather, that we stood apart. Social distancing was surely not an option for him. God could no longer bear to see his people die of fear in the face of death and condemnation. He couldn't stand the way men got entangled in guilt, and for some, how they looked for him but didn't find him. God wanted to join them, and he made himself a man. He took the name of a man, Jesus, son of Mary, originally from Nazareth, a small remote village in the mountains. On the outskirts of the Roman Empire, God became man. He doesn't force himself to take on a man's name and take on the appearance of a man like the gods of Greek mythology did. He comes in flesh and bone. It is he in person who is approaching. He does not come out of curiosity. He comes out of love, and he dies for love. He wants to be with us. He wants to slip under our skin, so to speak. And this is how he becomes man, body and soul, and experiences what we all experience. He saw sorrow and happiness. He cries and he laughs. He has friends and enemies. He knows hunger and thirst, and even fear and anguish. He knows fear just like us who are going through many fears in these turbulent times. Thus he is man, and he is and remains at the same time entirely God. God who forgives the sins of men, heals them in body and soul, strengthens them, blesses them, and satisfies them. And now, on this Friday, he is tied to the cross. It is God who is there, on the wood. It is the hands of Jesus, God and man at the same time, which are broken by the nails of the Roman soldiers which pierce them. On the hill of Golgotha, God goes deep into the abyss. He dies, He dies there on Golgotha. He dies today still, mowed down by a bullet in a country of the world. In another, he is imprisoned in a container exposed to the sun in the middle of a desert. Elsewhere, still, he is buried in his apartment, devastated by a bomb. He dies. Day becomes night. He's scared like many of us, and because he doesn't want us to be scared forever, he doesn't want to leave us alone. So he enters the long, dark night of death. God takes the most bitter path, so that there is no human path that God has not taken, that God has not followed himself. It is finished, said Jesus. This is how Jesus dies. This is how God dies. The mission is accomplished. God is man until the last breath, and he remains God eternally. For there in the abyss, in darkness, in death, all is accomplished. We have known fear before. We suspect that we will still know it. But Jesus, how could Jesus be afraid? He who is the Son of God, the model of faith, par excellence. Does this correspond to the Jesus as I imagine him, as he is described by others? How can Jesus be afraid? The fact is that Jesus is afraid, and he shows it. He talks about it. He does not give the impression that admitting fear is an admission of disbelief or little faith, unbecoming of a believer. I am overwhelmed with sadness to the point of death, he said. Or translated otherwise, I am broken under the weight of what I have to carry. This is how Jesus sums up his state of mind at the time, which should not surprise us. Faith, trust in God, a deep relationship with God, and fear are not mutually exclusive. And since it was like that for Jesus already, I can better accept it and assume it in my life. We meet Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, among the olive trees, and the olives, the fruits, are just waiting to be pressed. An image of what also awaits him, betrayal, abandonment by his friends, loneliness, false accusations, humiliation, harassment, suffering and pain. Jesus experienced all of this head-on. He felt it with all of his senses. It made him tremble inside and out. Jesus is not only God, but also fully human. And fear is something fundamentally human. Even if it is unpleasant and heavy, it is useful. It is actually a sensible reaction to an acute threat and acts as an alarm. Jesus is afraid, and he does not take the trouble to hide it from his fellow travellers. He does not seem to tell everyone about it, but neither does he isolate himself from the whole group of disciples before praying to his Father. He asks three of them to come with him, Peter, James, and John. And it is to those, certainly those closest to him, that he confides without shame. I am overwhelmed with sadness to the point of death, he tells them. He is not ashamed of it. Quite the contrary. The sadness recognized by Jesus and the fear and anguish mentioned by the evangelist Mark in his text are palpable. They are so much a part of life that we too have to expect them and know how to manage them. Jesus can teach us many things about this. First, the fact that Jesus faces his fear. He expresses it. He dares to call it by name, in front of him, in front of his companions, and in dialogue with God in prayer. Jesus does not want to go through this difficult time alone, and he does not want to burden anyone. To face the ordeal of suffering and death, he seeks communion with people he trusts and with whom he feels connected. They are not perfect people. They are his friends. They are his family. He wants to see them by his side in these trying times. Often the simple act of saying something to someone, and even just being physically close to someone, helps us maintain a place in our humanity, even in the midst of hardship. The example of Jesus gives the courage to look the things that make us afraid in the eye. His example in no way invites us to proudly or shamefully renounce the help that others might give. Shared fear is half the fear. We must not be alone in our fear. We must be open to receiving help. But fear has many facets. Sometimes we perceive things as a threat that requires a response from us. and it can be justified. However, an overinterpretation of events stirs up fears and triggers destructive reactions. The fear of failing an exam or a job interview, for example, can lead to a counterproductive panic fear that reduces the chances of success. What do we see of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane? In this situation, he seeks prayer, the relationship with his heavenly Father. He spreads before him all his feelings, his thoughts, his fears, and his hopes without any filter. He is convinced of one thing: God his Father is above all that threatens him. And what threatens Jesus is truly massive. Jesus very concretely asks God to protect him and free him from this threat. Abba, Father, for you everything is possible. Take this cup away from me. He knows that God the Father can do it. If Jesus himself sought the company of his disciples to accompany him in his last moments, he also knows that the Father is already accompanying him on his way. So if we ourselves need human relationships to experience trials, we also know that God our Father accompanies us in all life, as he accompanied Jesus Christ, our brother. We can and must come to God with our worries, our anxieties. I believe that by example, Jesus encourages us to tell God unequivocally how we see things, how we feel, and what we would like. And that shows me how seriously God takes my fear. He accompanies me on my uncertain path. He deals with what threatens me, what I feel as a threat, and also what my interpretation of events makes me feel. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus trembles before what he saw and what still awaits him. He wants this to stop. It's so understandable. And that's what so many people have prayed since. God, spare me this ordeal. Heal me. Heal him. Heal her. Look after me. Do we know all this? The Gospels are filled with stories in which Jesus asked God for something, such as healing the sick. And God listened to him. He responded concretely to his concrete requests. This is what people, and we too, have experienced time and time again. It's wonderful, it's so encouraging. But it is precisely in this situation that Jesus experiences the non-fulfillment of his request. Jesus must drink this bitter cup. The threat falls on him with force. Jesus suffers, trembles, and cries out. He feels his limits. This is also an experience that is not unknown to us. God does not answer all our prayers, or not as we would like. Of course, God listens to us. He wants us to tell him what touches us, what we think and want. But he remains sovereign in his responses and actions. He sees further. He sees me and sees everyone and everything else. Jesus understands this very well, and he adds a however to his request. Everything is possible for you. Take this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. So this formulation shows no resignation in Jesus. It is for us the expression of our deep confidence in the fact that not only does God our Father know more than us and see further than us, but that in everything and for everything, God is not indifferent to our future and accompanies us on our way. For us, this trust in a present God allows us to go through fear, anguish, distress, the unimaginable or what destroys our life. So God goes with us. That's our assurance. Our brothers and sisters, even if they are not perfect, also accompany us and form community with us. To add this, I would like to recall the account of another divine accompaniment. Secondly, Jesus accompanies. On the day of the resurrection, in the afternoon, two disciples of Jesus go to Emmaus talking about all that had happened. We read in Luke chapter 24, verses 15 to 18. As they talked and discussed these things with each other, Jesus himself came up and walked along with them, but they were kept from recognizing him. He asked them, "What are you discussing together as you walk along?" They stood still, their faces downcast. One of them, named Cleopas, asked him, "Are you the only one visiting Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" For the disciples, Jesus is no longer there. Now we must say goodbye to hope and choose the way back, a tragedy. Now what they lack is precisely the closeness to Jesus. They walk sadly, and Jesus approaches them. He accompanies them on the path long before he is recognized. And that is the beauty of this story. Jesus takes the time. He takes the time to be human among men. The sadness of the two men is genuine, so Jesus takes the initiative and asks them what they are talking about. So the text tells us they stopped looking sad. Stopping on the road to mourning is not as simple as it may seem, because that's where what needs to come out really comes out. What the two want to leave behind is suddenly in front of them. What had to pass and disappear becomes alive again. Touched by the closeness of Jesus without having yet recognized him, the atmosphere changes. Liveliness takes place in the midst of mourning. You can read it later in Luke's text if you want. One of the two disciples cannot help but open up and tell everything. Then their hope is alive again, revived by the presence of Jesus. It is only in its very veiled presence that what seems completely insane becomes perfectly possible. It is only in his presence that what has been lost is found. Let us at least remember this. Jesus is there because he has decided not to leave us alone, out of love for us. Even if our eyes are not open, even if we do not see him, and he accompanies us. Thirdly, the church accompanies. I would add that we are made to live in community. We are beings of relationship. It is there already present in the previous stories, in the garden where Jesus was accompanied by three disciples, and on the way where two disciples were accompanied by Jesus. We walk together and we need each other. You may say to yourself, for me, it's different. I'm doing very well on my own. Yet I keep saying that we need each other. This is also what the author of the letter to the Hebrews seems to think, but it goes a little further. He says it is important not only to be with each other, but also that we take care of each other. I read this passage to you. Hebrews chapter 10, verses 23 to 25. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how we may spur one another on toward love and good deeds. Not giving up meeting together as some are in the habit of doing, but encouraging one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching. The Hebrews for whom this letter is written form a Christian community. They are encouraged to watch over each other. But aren't we always attentive to how others behave? Don't we always notice their mistakes? I seriously wonder if I want anyone to pay attention to me. Well, I like that other people pay attention to me, yes, maybe, and I appreciate not being transparent like glass, but someone watching over me, an adult person that does not suit me at all, I can take care of myself just fine. So the writer of the letter associates this attention to the other with a concrete objective. This duty of watch should lead us to motivate each other to act with love towards one another. There are groups outside of the church that everyone has heard of, self-help groups in which people with the same type of difficulties in life meet to encourage each other. And part of our organisation here includes groups formed in the same spirit. Our first major support group is the church. The church is the gathering of all Christians, but we cannot do everything in support and monitoring. So there are others, smaller ones, where you can talk, share, such as the meeting of the young people or the house groups. But there again, sometimes a structure can be too big for the accompaniment and the previous day. So there is a need to create a smaller, more private or more intimate group that can be shared eventually towards healing. And in all these groups, each one is being essential. We practice love and mercy. The Christian community is something very special. Jesus promised to be particularly present there. Fraternity can be experienced there, and the help given can be effective when it is thought out and organized. So in conclusion, accompany and be accompanied. In the three stories this morning, this experience was lived out by disciples of Jesus. I remind you, we have read it, that Jesus himself asked Peter, James and John to accompany him in the Garden of Gethsemane, so as not to go alone in anguish. We don't have to walk alone in the midst of the ordeal. I remind you, we also read it, that Jesus himself accompanied two of his disciples on the road to Emmaus before their distress finally gave way to hope. We must remember that God is always with us in life, through good times and bad. Finally, the author of the letter to the Hebrews reminded us that the church is the place where spontaneous and organized accompaniment makes it possible to respond to the vital needs of each other. We are dependent on each other and must think of the church in that way. Amen.